Hello and welcome to Power Play for this Friday, December 3rd. I'm Joyce Napier. Coming up on the show, a boostering Canada.
There is a need, and I would say even a responsibility for NACI at the federal level to help provinces come closer together in answering the questions.
The National Advisory Committee on Immunization strongly recommends COVID-19 vaccine boosters for everyone over the age of 50. How quickly can Canada secure the doses, and what will the provinces do? We'll ask Canada's procurement minister, Philomena Tassi. Then, making sense of Omicron travel restrictions.
It's quite complicated. I think we're going to have to put up some tools on the website so that travelers can actually figure this out.
Even the chief medical officer knows Canada's new travel rules are confusing. When will airport testing launch everywhere, and will domestic restrictions be needed to curb the spread of this latest variant of concern? We'll ask the minister, then get a medical fact check. Plus, pushing back on American protectionism. International Trade Minister Mary Ng led an all-party delegation to Washington this week, fighting for a Canadian carve-out on President Biden's Buy American agenda. But is she coming away with any wins? We'll ask the minister. And the rapidly rising cost of living. Inflation and the cost of living dominated political debate this week, but is there anything concrete that the government can do to ease pressure on your pocketbook? The strategy session digs in. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players.
We don't want to wait too long because if we wait to get the actual data on, you know, increasing hospitalizations and other lagging indicators, then it'll be too late because, you know, even with a vaccination program, it takes 2 weeks, for an individual who receives a vaccine to actually get, maximum protection. And so all those factors have led to this moment.
Canadians over 50 should get a COVID-19 booster dose now. That's the recommendation from the National Advisory Committee on Immunization. What about everyone else? Boosters can be offered to people ages 18 to 49, depending on their individual risk and where they live. NACI also says those living in long-term care or those who have two doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine and frontline healthcare workers are some of the people who must be prioritized for boosters. So, does Canada have enough boosters? The Omicron variant has thrown a new hurdle in Canada's ongoing fight, and there's no guarantee that every province will follow NACI's recommendations. Is the federal government ready to meet a patchwork provincial needs? Let's find out. And joining me now is Procurement Minister Philomena Tassi. Welcome to Power Play, Minister. Thanks so much for being there. I know it's been a busy day for you. So NACI is recommending Canadians age 50 and over get a COVID-19 booster. So my question is, does Canada have enough boosters to accommodate that recommendation? And, you know, if it is expanded to all, as many provinces are already doing, would you have enough doses?
Well, thanks, Joyce. A pleasure to be with you. Thanks for the invitation. And the short answer to that question is yes. You know, I really have to thank my predecessor, Minister Anand, here, together with the department, who, really procured the number of vaccines that we knew would be necessary to put all Canadians in a place where if they wanted the vaccine, they would get it. And of course, we want all Canadians to get the vaccine. We didn't want eligibility to be not having the vaccines to be an impediment. So yes, we are in a very good place, and all eligible Canadians who wish to have a vaccine, we have those vaccines available.
So I'm wondering now that you say this, there is a lot of pressure on, sort of richer countries to share those vaccines and not to hog those vaccines. Are you getting a lot of pressure? Well, now you say you have enough for everybody to have a dose or a third dose or a booster shot. Do you have a lot of, is there a lot of pressure on you and the government to actually get rid of those or give those away to countries that don't even have one dose, where people don't even have a first dose?
So what I would say on this, Joyce, is we absolutely agree that no one is safe until everyone is safe. And so that means, you know, we are committed to equitable global access to vaccines. And in this regard, we have committed to 200 million, the equivalent of 200 million vaccines. And so, you know, I think that we all recognize that we want everyone to get the vaccine. That's the way through this this pandemic. And so that commitment is a strong commitment. In terms of the vaccines that we're procuring, I mean, for us, we always want to ensure that we have ample supply for Canadians. We want to encourage Canadians to step up and get the vaccines that they are eligible for. And so that balance is always there, but we have made that strong commitment of 200 million, equivalent of 200 million doses.
I want to go to another announcement that you made today. So about these antiviral pills. So Merck and Pfizer pills, Health Canada, I know, has not yet approved them, but you have deals in place to purchase 1 million Pfizer oral antiviral pills, plus 500,000 Merck COVID pills. Will these be eventually available with a prescription? What is I know they're not approved yet, but we're looking down the road here. Are these kinds of pill that would be available in a pharmacy on prescription, or will they be controlled in hospital environments?
Okay, so excellent question, and I'm really happy that you've asked me this today because it's really good news. And this is us looking forward, right, having the foresight. As you mentioned, the Health Canada has not approved these yet, but we know that once they are approved, we wanted to ensure that we were in line to get these antiviral pills. The advantage with these pills is they can be taken at home. So it takes the pressure off of the hospitals, which we know is really important. And so this antiviral pill will, in fact, it's effective to limit the impacts of COVID-19 to keep people out of the hospitals. So we have procured a significant amount of doses, as you've said, 1 million from Pfizer, 500,000 from Merck with the option for 500,000 more. And what our intention is to, of course, distribute these to provinces and territories so that they can equitably, so that they can have these pills available. And, of course, when we do this, we also look at areas that are of a larger concern, right? So if there's flare-ups in certain areas and there may be more support needed, that's always taken into consideration. But we've worked very collaboratively with provinces and territories throughout this. And so we are delighted that we have this other tool now in the toolbox in order to ensure that Canadians have another means of ensuring that the impacts or effects of COVID-19 are limited and minimized.
That's interesting. And you have no idea of the timeline or when Health Canada would be approving these.
No, I can say that with Merck, they put in their application for regulatory approval August 13th of this year, and Pfizer has just put in their request for regulatory approval. So, and Health Canada has to do the work that Health Canada does. We want to ensure that once these pills are going through the regulatory approval and approved, that they are safe for Canadians. That's really important. And so we want to give them the time to do that. But look, Health Canada has expedited these approvals because they know that we are in need of these across Canada.
I want to try. I know we don't have a lot of time, but I want to move to travel measures during the rise of this new variant Omicron. So the federal government says it will test everyone on international flights except those returning from the U.S. So how long will it take for these tests to be in place at airports? And also, Minister, do you have enough tests? And then I want to ask you also about rapid tests, because testing seems to be the way to contain this. So how long will it take for this testing facilities to be at airports?
Okay, so this is something that is being implemented as we speak. We do have contracts with what are called end-to-end service providers at airports. So they actually conduct the tests. There is flexibility in those agreements in order to have them take on these tests. Those are things that we are working out with these providers. And so I was just at a press conference with Minister Duclos, where he has confirmed that we are working as quickly as we can to bring the various airports on board and provide them with the supports that they need to implement this. And really, this is about slowing down the virus, right? And so we as a government want to take a leadership role, do everything we can to slow down the government. Your question about rapid tests, I think, is a very important one. You know, our government has procured over 102.4 million rapid tests. We are distributing these to provinces and territories. It's critical that these tests get in the hands of Canadians so that they can be used. And we are always looking ahead to ensure that Canadians are going to have the supports that they need in order to combat COVID-19. So from a procurement perspective, we're continuing to procure a number of tools to put Canadians in a very good place, because we know that there's great anxiety and concern with respect to this pandemic.
100.
And we're not through it yet, Joyce, as I'm sure you're aware. We've done great work, and Canadians have stepped up, which has been absolutely fantastic. But now we just want to ensure that all precautions are taken so that the light is there at the end of the tunnel. We want to get to it.
100 million rapid tests. That's a lot of them. Procurement Minister Philomena Tassi, thanks for joining us. Have yourself a wonderful weekend, man.
Thank you, Joyce. You as well.
You just heard from the government. Now let's hear from a medical voice. Joining us now is Dr. Alan Grill, Chief of Family Medicine at Markham Stouffville Hospital, to react to today's booster shot announcement. Dr. Grill, welcome to Power Play. Nice to have you with us. What do you make of that decision? I'm very curious about that, of separating, you know, adults into two categories for boosters. So 50 and plus, and those 50 and under. What's the science here?
Yeah, for sure. Thanks so much for having me tonight. So, you know, boosters are obviously a very good idea. We know from antibody studies that immunity wanes or goes down after 6 months of the vaccines available in Canada. We also have seen in other countries, specifically in Europe, Israel, even here in Canada, the cases are going up. And in some of those countries, they also have vaccination rates similar to Canada after 6 months. And, you know, people are moving indoors because of the winter weather as well. And the other thing out of Israel that was interesting was they had a study where they boosted a certain percentage of their population, and it showed that it decreased your risk against hospitalization and severe cases by like 90% when they got boosted. So, you know, we're calling them boosters, but I think more and more people are referring to these as third dose vaccines. It reduces your own risk. It reduces your risk of spreading to others. And I'm really happy that NASCI's statement came out today talking about those at high risk, you know, people over 50, you know, those that have dialysis, obviously Indigenous populations. You know, your question about whether they should do this for under 50 is a very good question. I mean, I think ultimately everybody is going to need a third dose. We've been fortunate in Canada that because we spaced out the doses for a lot of people, you know, they waited about 8 weeks between doses. I think it's bought us some time in terms of better immunity than other countries that had the lower interval between doses. But you got to think about things like implementation. You know, family doctors are busier now with things. More people are coming to our office now that they're vaccinated. Hospitals are trying to get back in catching up on things like surgeries. You know, public health is working really hard. So you have to think about implementation, but we have to keep our eye on the science. And if it turns out that the people under 50, if we start seeing more cases or we get that signal, we have to pivot urgently. And I have full confidence in the provinces and NASCI that if they need to make a stronger recommendation and pivot, they will.
Oh, yeah, but provinces have already, you know, decided on their own. There are a few provinces, several provinces that will give everybody a third dose, right? So they're also prioritizing NASCI shots or a third shot for people who received AstraZeneca or Johnson and Johnson vaccines. Why is that?
Yeah. So we've seen, again, from studies, when they compared, you know, the Pfizer vaccine, the Moderna vaccine, with AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson. It just turns out that people that received AstraZeneca as a full regimen or Johnson & Johnson, their waning immunity was actually worse than if you had one of the mRNA vaccines, you know, the Pfizer or Moderna. And because of that, they're making a recommendation that those individuals, after 6 months, their immunity is likely to be even lower than the rest of the Canadians that got the mRNA vaccine. So it makes sense that we boost them and we put them in the category that's highest risk. That's where the recommendation came from. And you're right, some provinces have already made the decision to give vaccines to people 18 plus. And, you know, with the new Omicron variant that's out there, even though we're still learning about it, it's going to take a few weeks to figure this whole thing out, it doesn't hurt to boost your immunity against a new variant. And we've seen with the vaccines that we've used in Canada so far, including, you know, AstraZeneca, it has worked against the variants in this country. And there's no reason to believe that the current vaccines that we use shouldn't work as well. So by boosting those individuals and raising their protection, it's going to hopefully reduce their chance of getting COVID and, more importantly, reduce their chance of spreading it to the more vulnerable population, specifically those over age 50 and those with complex medical problems.
I only have a few seconds left, Dr. Grill, but these pills from Merck and Pfizer, antiviral pills, are they a game changer?
Yeah. You know, I think as our my previous colleague mentioned, it's always great to have more tools in your toolbox. I mean, we're still waiting for Health Canada approval. And so what we have so far is information from the companies. Now, the information does look good. If you take these pills and you have COVID-19, it's supposed to reduce your chance of getting a severe infection and landing you in hospital and even preventing death. We won't know until we get further data and Health Canada looks at it, but it looks promising. They're oral, so they're easy to take. You know, there's going to be some implementation issues. You know, how quickly can somebody who comes down with symptoms get the test, then get access to the prescription, because it has to be done within a certain time frame. So we're going to have to figure that out on the ground.
Yeah.
And I think as a family doctor, I would say prevention is always more important than treatment. So please, if you're eligible for a first, second, or third dose of the COVID vaccine, roll up your sleeve, get your shot. We're happy to see you.
Words of wisdom, Dr. Alan Grill. Thank you so much. Have a lovely weekend.
Stay safe.
And we're going to take you to Abbotsford now, where the mayor has announced some residents can finally come home. Listen to this.
The map here beside me, which is also being shown on the screen of your YouTube channel, details our return home plan. There are four main areas where evacuation orders will start to be lifted in the days ahead: South, Central, Lake Bottom, and North. Our objective is to ensure that as many people as possible can return home safely while not being held up by areas that may not be accessible due to unsafe conditions. Our corresponding return home website includes this map, and as evacuation orders are lifted, residents will be able to click on their corresponding area and find specific and essential information for their return to their properties. This will include information on which routes are open for accessing their property, where they can find potable water, as well as who to contact for support as they start their cleanup efforts. As the first step in implementing our return home plan, I am lifting the evacuation order for the north area of Sumas Prairie effective immediately. With the lifting of this order, we are asking everyone to exercise extreme caution as they make their way through this newly opened area, especially over the next few days as we have snow in our forecast. Over the coming days, additional services will be made available to the people accessing their properties in this area, including potable water and debris management. We know that for many of the residents, returning to their homes and farms will not be easy. Our rapid damage assessment teams have and will be continuing to assess more than 3,000 structures across Sumas Prairie. Some, including homes, may not be inhabitable. We recognize this may bring many questions, particularly for those who receive a do not enter notice. We have set up a special phone line to assist people with questions that they have about their assessment. This number is provided on the rapid damage assessment notice that residents will find.
And that was an update by the mayor of Abbotsford, Henry Braun, saying that some people can come home and some houses may not be inhabitable. Now, moving on, the issue dominating debate on Parliament Hill, the high cost of living.
There's prices going up across the board. She has the opportunity to ask the Bank of Canada to get inflation back down to 2%. Will she do it? Yes or no?
Monetary policy decisions about interest rates and the money supply are the province of the Bank of Canada. It is fiscal policy decisions about spending and taxation, which is the job of the government. I think Canadians would be right to ask themselves whether a party that doesn't even understand this basic distinction could ever be trusted in government.
Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland will deliver a fiscal update on December 14th, just 3 days before the House is set to rise for the winter break. The snapshot on the federal government's finances comes at a time of high inflation, flooding in BC, and the arrival of the Omicron variant in Canada. The Conservative bench blames the Trudeau government's stimulus spending on contributing to inflation, calling it just inflation. So as the government escalates its response to the new Omicron variant, will more spending be on the books? And will that further inflame the Tories' line of attack over inflation? Let's bring in our Friday panel of strategists to weigh in. Greg McCracken from Proof Strategies leans Liberal. Adrian Batra, the Toronto Sun's editor-in-chief, brings the conservative voice. Cameron Holmstrom, a consultant with Blue Sky Strategy Group and a former NDP staffer. And finally, Greg Weston from Ernst Cliff Strategy Group. He has a nonpartisan perspective. Nice to see you all. Happy Friday, strategists. Adrian, I'm going to start with you. An exclusive Nanos poll for CTV's PowerPoint found that inflation edged out the pandemic and climate change as the biggest worry for Canadians. So the Conservatives are linking Liberal pandemic spending to inflation. Can it backfire on the Tories for politicizing inflation when, in fact, it's a global issue?
I don't think that it can, for the very simple fact that this is the number one issue that are facing Canadians every day they walk out of their house, when they go to the grocery store, when they look at, you know, potentially buying goods and services for Christmas, whatever it may be. Joyce, I think that the Conservatives have touched on the one issue that is nonpartisan. Like, every Canadian is facing it, and they're facing it deeply, and it's very real. And the challenge, I think, for the opposition parties, for all of them, is that what you just saw in the clip you played just before we all came on, and that's Minister Freeland, who is very good at reading her talking points, but doesn't seem to, or it doesn't appear to have a good handle or understanding of the realities on the ground. And I think that's where the disconnect is. So if the Conservatives need to continue, I believe, along this line of attack against the Liberal government, because it resonates with the average Canadian, because they are the ones that are paying these prices and contending with it every day.
Well, Greg McCracken, but, you know, inflation is eclipsing other issues for voters. And does the government need to act fast to make sure that, you know, just inflation that became a pretty hot hashtag out there doesn't catch fire?
Well, I mean, we often say about polls, it's a snapshot in time when they're about politics. About this issue, I'm not sure in the summer inflation would have outpaced healthcare or concern about the pandemic. And we don't know where the variant's going to go. So, but right now, I think this is a very realistic poll. We've talked about inflation a lot, even on this panel. I think the challenge for the Conservatives is to have the discipline to stick on message. And there's two issues with that. One, might be inside the Ottawa bubble, but, you know, Conservative MP was upset that Stephen Guilbeault had a bike in his background, that considered it a prop. And I saw someone who worked for Stephen Harper, someone who I consider to be a quite smart political observer. And she said, you know, if this is what the Conservatives are going to focus on, they're never going to be back in government. The other way is the way they handle it. And you referred to this, that they're making a play on the prime minister's first name because it ends in IN. Well, so does Erin O'Toole. If you're going to simplify issues that much, it's really hard for Canadians to take you seriously. And looking at other Nanos polling, Erin O'Toole is still not doing very well. And I think if you were to ask Canadians right now, do you think you made the right choice in the last election? And, you know, with Prime Minister Trudeau, you know, as the winner, I think a lot of people are going to say yes. There's no buyer's remorse that they didn't put Erin O'Toole in. They're fighting in their own caucus about vaccines. They're doing these silly stunts. So I think the opposition has to be very careful. This is a strong issue for Canadians, but Canadians want it taken seriously.
Cameron, Erinflation, that could be another hashtag that Greg suggested. But so the Liberals, you know, tout their $10 a day childcare and plans for more affordable housing as a response to the high cost of living. But that won't happen for 3 to 5 years. But those, you know, are long-term solution. The NDP is calling for even more spending. I'm taking PharmaCare as an example, more COVID relief. But what is the NDP actually suggesting to help Canadians, you know, who feel the pinch at the grocery store?
Well, at the end of the day, the suggestion comes back to not pulling back the support too soon. I think that's the key thing, because let's face it, as we've seen COVID supports be pulled back, we've seen food bank usage spike. We've seen these kinds of other helps being taken up more and more. And this is where I honestly take my biggest issue with both the government and the Conservatives' approach to this at the moment, is that they both know what the problem is in people's minds. And we see it. You know, you go to the grocery store, you go to fill up your car, you're seeing it every day. So you know what the problem is. The problem is you have the Conservatives not willing to point to what a solution might be, or even point to the wrong, they're not even pointing to the right problem. They're not even willing to admit what the real problem is. They're trying to pin blame where blame does not belong in this case. But for the Liberals, they're not offering the solution either. Yes, $10 a day childcare will save you money eventually if you have children. Guess what? I've got a 9-year-old. I don't need childcare now. It's not doing a darn thing to help make my life any cheaper. Same thing for housing. You know, if you're going to pay for more housing, more supply, that is needed, and that will help down the road too. But if you can't find a place to rent today or you can't afford to buy today, that's not helping you right in this moment. And I honestly believe that just a little bit of honesty with Canadians is what would be appreciated at this point. Like, if this is truly out of our hands, we need to be upfront about that and be willing to try to pull other levers to help that. To basically point to COVID helps and saying we're spending too much to help people, you know what? That's disingenuous. And I think that's part of the slippery slope for the Conservatives in particular. It's one thing to say, I see the problem. But if you're selling snake oil as a solution, you're not going to win anyone's trust. You know, to me, it's kind of like saying, I admit COVID's a problem. Here's the ivermectin. You know, like that's how I look at Pierre Poilievre's lines when it comes to this. And it's not helpful.
True that. I'm not hearing a lot of solutions, too. I mean, I'm hearing a lot of talking points in the House and great questions. You know, Greg Weston, so are MPs doing Canadians a favor by turning inflation, cost of living into a political football? Because there's some really good attacks, some really, you know, clever answers, but I don't hear a lot of solutions in the House.
Well, I think this is going to be one of the most important points in the upcoming fall economic statement, Joyce, that you mentioned at the beginning. It's coming 3 days before everybody is going to break for Christmas, and families will be gathering this season. So what is that message going to be? Well, it has to be a big part of that message has to be it's an economic statement. What is the state of the economy and why? Where is this inflation coming from? Why are our food prices high? Why are gas prices high? And oh, by the way, why did gas prices drop, you know, 10 or 12 cents this week? The message the government has to do, it has to do some explaining. Erin O'Toole is not doing too much explaining. If he were, he would mention that the central bank if they want to actually bring those inflation rates down using the central bank, is to raise interest rates. I don't think we're going to see him rise in the House of Commons anytime soon and say, will this government promise to raise interest rates and drive everybody's mortgages through the roof? I don't think so. So what's happening in the House of Commons right now is not helpful to Canadians. No real shock there. But this economic statement that is coming up on the 14th is going to be a very, very important piece of government communications, letting Canadians know what's going on, what's behind it and how we're going to come out of this and when.
Well, it will certainly be a reality check for a lot of Canadians. And it comes on the 14th, and it comes only 3 days before the House arises for 6 weeks. So there won't be much time for debate, but at least Canadians will have 6 weeks to digest it. Greg McCachran, Adrian Batra, Cameron Holmstrom, and Greg Weston, thank you for this. Thanks for your thoughts, and have yourselves a great weekend.
Thanks, Trace.
And coming up, fighting American protectionism. A Team Canada coalition spent the last few days in Washington pushing for some relief from Biden's Buy American policies. The U.S. president is pushing policies that would slam Canada's auto sector. After the break, we ask International Trade Minister Mary Ng if Canada has anything to show for this lobbying effort. Stay with PowerPlay. And welcome back. 2 weeks after Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his gang of ministers met with President Joe Biden at the Three Amigos Summit, International Trade Minister Mary Ng returned to Washington to meet with U.S. lawmakers to fight Biden's Buy American provisions. This time, Minister Ng was joined by a cross-party delegation of MPs. There was a lot on the Canadian delegation's plate, concerns over a proposed U.S. tax credit for American-made electric vehicles, higher duties on softwood lumber, and an export ban on PEI potatoes. But did this Team Canada approach sway any U.S. politicians on Capitol Hill to intervene on Canada's behalf? Or has Team Canada returned from D.C. empty-handed? Let's find out. And joining me from Washington, D.C. is International Trade Minister Mary Ng. Minister, welcome to Power Play. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us, because I think you've had a busy few days. So you're in Washington with a delegation of parliamentarians from all parties. You were there a few weeks ago with the Prime Minister. I'm wondering if you this time will be leaving Washington with assurances from the Biden administration that Canada will be spared some of those Buy American provisions that they are studying right now?
Yeah, Joyce, thank you so much. And I am here with my parliamentary colleagues from all sides. I would say that we are here as Team Canada, because in addition to them, we have the consul generals from, you know, from across the country, from across the USA, the Canadian consul generals who are also here, and a number of business organizations as well as labor representatives are also here. So it's important that I'm here at this particular time, because the EV provisions that are in the Build Back Better bill, of course, is being studied right now and is on the Senate floor. So important for me to meet with senators. I've had about six meetings with senators and from bipartisan, so on both sides. And Team Canada has had yet another number of meetings. So about 50 meetings that have taken place, continuing to advocate for Canada and to indicate the discriminatory nature of this part of the Build Back Better bill in the EV incentives, and how it would hurt Canadian jobs, the hundreds of thousands of jobs. So really making sure that we are making ourselves heard to the senators who are doing this very work right now before the Senate.
So Have you gotten any assurances? Because that's what the Prime Minister was there for a couple of weeks ago. I understand that this tax credit the Americans want to give on the electric vehicles is a slap, a punch to the Canadian auto industry. But I'm wondering, okay, so you've talked, it passed the House of Representatives when you were there in Washington with the Prime Minister. It's before the Senate now. The Senate can tweak it. You could get a waiver. Canada could get a waiver. Do you get a sense that you're being heard? You know, it's difficult for Canadians to get heard in Washington. I lived there long enough to know that for Canadian officials, because you're not a problem. If you were a big problem, then you would have probably more attentive ears. So are they hearing you? And do you get the sense that they will tweak it understanding, you know, the repercussions on the Canadian auto industry.
Yeah, well, I mean, am I being heard? I think I am being heard. I'm meeting with senators on both sides of the aisle. They have certainly indicated to me that they are not ready to vote for this yet and that there is still some runway to work. So it is important that we are here doing this very important work. Of course, we're working on, of course, we're open to a range of solutions. I mean, bottom line for me is a solution for Canada. We have made
When you talk about a range of solutions that you have proposed, Chrystia Freeland saying when you were there a few weeks ago that we like to suggest that to them solutions. What are they? You have a range, but it's not that wide range of solutions.
Well, I think that what's really important is to have these very important discussions. Some of the senators that I met with didn't know that this was offside of CUSMA or USMCA. I made them aware of that. They undertook the, they've committed that they will continue to work with us. Others, because I'm meeting with senators on both sides, some absolutely agree with Canada. So I think that what's important right now is to keep doing this work, keep working towards a solution for Canada. And that work, this work is not going to get solved overnight.
No.
I mean, I'm continuing this work, of course, following up on the very good work that my prime minister has done. And we're here. And to your point about, whether they are listening to Canadians, well, there's some 50 meetings that have taken, that have taken place. I also met with bipartisan labor unions this morning who also understand that and agree that the integration of our supply chains is important because it really has helped to create prosperity for both, for workers on both sides and how powerful this is.
I understand that if you're bringing up the new trade deal, the new NAFTA, CUSMA, whatever you want to call it, means that you're telling them this could be in violation. So that could be one of Canada's steps in this whole process. And the reason why you're in Washington, I mean, they're possible violation of NAFTA, World Trade Organization as well, their rules as well. So I want to go to another issue that you're probably having to deal with is the softwood lumber issue. The Americans have double tariff on softwood lumber. Are you getting anywhere with that as well? I understand that they listen to you. Have they heard you?
Well, I've raised this issue at every opportunity, as you know, Joyce, with my counterpart, the U.S. Trade Representative, and certainly raised it with the Secretary of Commerce as well. But just before this interview, I met with the American home builders here in America. And here's what we agree. We agree that that these tariffs increase the price for building homes. Housing affordability is an important issue for Americans. Making sure that that first-time homebuyers get those homes is an important objective here. And tariffs, especially the increase in these very unjustified tariffs, only increases home prices for Americans. So we need to keep pushing on this very important issue. I, of course, have been in regular contact with the Canadian softwood lumber industry, and we're going to keep up the pressure on this front as well.
Yeah, and interesting because Canada has, this is not the first time we've been covering this actually for decades, the softwood lumber issue. And each and every time Canada brings the United States before a trade tribunal wins the case. So you may end up by taking with taking the Americans before the NAFTA tribunal, the World Trade Organization, the tribunal that will settle one more softwood lumber issue with the United States. So, I'm wondering if this relationship is any easier than with Donald Trump?
Well, on the issue of softwood and the various panels that that Canada has litigated at, whether it be at NAFTA or at CUSMA and at the WTO, I would remind and I think you have as well, that as recent as August of 2020, that the rulings tend to favor Canada, that we are a fair trading partner that plays by the rules. We're assessing our, we're assessing taking this this sort of new AR review before the panel, but we have litigated and we have been successful in that litigation. And the case that I made, it's not the case. I mean, what we shared with the home builders this morning is that these tariffs are detrimental to, you know, to workers and to the home builders in here in America. And it goes against one of the objectives of creating greater housing affordability for Americans. So
absolutely,
we must continue doing this work. And I will keep doing that for our industry.
Minister, that's all the time we have. Thanks so much for taking the time. I know you had a busy schedule in Washington. So have yourself a very nice weekend. That was International Trade Minister Mary Ng talking to us from Washington. And coming up, politicians wrap up another week on the Hill with the first legislation of this sitting passing in the House. So who came out on top this week? The Press Gallery digs into their plays and misplays next. Stay with us. And welcome back. The first bill of the 44th Parliament officially passed the House this week. That came from as a surprise motion from the Conservatives to finally pass a ban on conversion therapy. But it was inflation, or as the Conservatives are rebranding it, just inflation, that continues to dominate question period while Omicron continues to spread across the world. So who came out on top this week? Let's bring in the Press Gallery for their plays and misplays. Rachel Aiello is the online politics producer for ctvnews.ca. She also writes the Capital Dispatch newsletter, a must read. And Susan Delacourt is a columnist with the Toronto Star, another must read. Hello, colleagues. Happy Friday. Nice to see you. I'm going to start with you, Rachel Aiello. You have a play. Take it away.
Yeah, Joyce. So my play of the week and maybe even play of the month for the Conservatives was their decision to put forward this motion to unanimously pass the conversion therapy ban bill through the House this week. You know, it's not often that I'm surprised by what goes on up here, but this one kind of took me aback. And I think it's a play for two main reasons. The first being this bill might actually stand a chance of passing for real this time. Still got to get through the Senate, but it's going to bring conversion therapy one step closer to being ended. It means the end of this harmful and traumatic practice. But also it means, hopefully, that politicians will stop politicizing LGBTQ lives. How many times in the election campaign did we see this come up as a wedge issue? So that's one win. The other win, maybe a bit more cynically, is for the Conservatives strategically. By doing it in an opposition or in a unanimous consent motion, you didn't have to see every MP stand up and be counted. So while there could still be Conservatives who don't support this idea, they just had to stay silent or stay out of the House, and we won't know, and the opposition parties won't have, or the Liberals won't have, the ability to throw that back at them going forward. You know, 52 of your MPs still voted against this. We don't have a number on that anymore.
That, it was a clever move, and also, you know, takes away an ammunition from the Liberals, who, you know, can now... more difficult to paint them as a bunch of, you know, socially regressive parties. So that was kind of an interesting, very interesting move. And yes, surprising, you're right. Susan, what do you think of the strategy behind the move from the Conservatives?
Well, you know, even after I've been here so many years, I'm still a bit of a suck. And the sight of Liberals and Conservatives hugging each other was pretty nice. It was nice to see. It was a sign that maybe they've listened during the election campaign to Rachel is right. It was the play of the week or the month. It took everybody by surprise. There are good policy reasons to think this was a good idea. There are good political reasons to think it was a good idea. But I think for the public watching, it was a nice thing to see that Parliament can actually move. And I think it tells us the story that something maybe more interesting is going on in this Parliament than we had anticipated or feared. So, you know, when we're talking about plays of the week, definitely this was one. Rachel is right. It's probably one of the bigger ones, but I was heartened by it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I watched them hugging in the House and thought, well, this is, you know, for the books, parliamentary history. It doesn't happen that often.
No.
but it still has to go to the Senate, Rachel, where it died last time. What are there any challenges? I mean, these senators can hardly not send it back to the House. I mean, this is a unanimous adoption from the House. Does this silence the Senate in a way?
I don't know if it's going to silence the Senate. I think what is going to be interesting to watch is, because there was no study this time in the House, whether senators feel that having a more robust study in the Senate is merited, especially because the bill has been expanded. It's got a broader scope than it did last time. The big concern for the senators last session was they ran out of runway. They didn't feel like they wanted to rubber stamp this. There was concerns raised. Whether or not they still feel that those concerns need to be addressed, I would suspect are still there. And also, I think if there are detractors to this bill, I'm sure they are all now putting all of their attention on the senators and trying to make their case for why they need to have these points heard. Now, whether they actually amend it and send it back to the House is another question, especially given, as you said, the message they've gotten from the House. But I do not expect, again, I stand to be surprised once again, that this bill will be fast-tracked through the Senate. Now, a big ask has been, we don't want to re-traumatize survivors of conversion therapy, so maybe we don't need to re-listen to that testimony. So we'll see what shape that might take, but I do expect to see some form of a study instead of just another all the way through.
Yeah, I'm very curious to see what the Senate is going to do when it's unanimous in the House, an appointed Senate. You know, it will be interesting to see if they play bad cop, if they're the ones, yeah, that say, yeah, they'll do the dirty work. Susan, you're also handing out a play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it almost went by unnoticed, but the Speaker of the House of Commons this week, in continuing with what's a good week for the Conservatives theme, ruled in favor of the Conservatives in their complaint about the way in which the vaccine mandates and the rules of the new returning Parliament were established. It was very quiet. It came amid a bunch of other stuff. And Anthony Rota sort of demonstrated why he probably won the election for Speaker, which is that he put the rules of the House and the rules of Parliament above his own, you know, liberal, he is a liberal, an elected liberal, but he sided with the Conservatives on this one. And the Conservatives, to their credit, did not stand up on their chairs and point fingers and say, told you so, we were right. It was like, mm-hmm. Thank you. Let's move on. And in keeping with my optimism about this Parliament, it told me that something is going on here, that they've decided, despite all the, you know, the nonsense in question period about just inflation and the silliness, that as soon as question period ends, twice this week, we have seen some cross-party cooperation and cross-party understanding that I think says that adults are in the building, which is a much needed and much desired outcome of the election. Grown-ups are good.
Nice. Yeah, that actually, yes, it was a good week, a week of plays. You know, that's a good way to finish the week and a good way to finish our show with Rachel Aiello and Susan Delacourt, with two plays and two good ones. It's true. And maybe it isn't as toxic as they said it was going to be this Parliament. Have
Fingers
yourself
crossed.
A great weekend.
You too.
And that's your Power Play Day in Politics. Thank you for being here with us. We'll be back right here on Monday. Have a great weekend.